is. And sorry, I am going to share my screen because I have some slides that I would like for you to see. Hopefully maybe help you to understand the lesson a little better. So let me just get this set up. There we are, there we go. Okay, well, welcome everyone. It is great to have everyone here tonight. And we're gonna be talking about the call to be a learner. And we've got a huge section in Mark to talk about tonight. And honestly, it's a very important section. It's my favorite section of Mark. I have many sections of Mark that I love. Like in chapters one, there's a day in the life of Jesus that's fantastic. I shared about one of the sections, which was the section on four lessons and of fear and faith, and four stories that are woven together with fear and faith in them. Mark did an amazing job giving us those stories. And later there's a section where you'll see 3 days in the life of Christ, back to back to back, Jesus in the temple. And so that section, I just think it's fantastic when you can actually visualize these 3 days in the life of Jesus and put them together chronologically like Mark does. He doesn't do that throughout his book, but there's a couple of times where he does do it. And tonight, this section is all about being a learner. It's about being a disciple and what it means to follow Jesus and the call to discipleship, which is a call for all of us. It was a call for those 12, but it's a call for all of us as well. So there's a lot of lessons that we can learn, but it's a massive material for one night. We're talking about half of chapter 8 all the way through chapter 10. But I'm going to focus in on three stories. And I call this, and this is not just me, scholars call this a sandwich. It's a Markan sandwich, where you start with something, end with something, and there's something in between. In this case, we're going to start with the story of a blind man. We're going to end with the story of a blind man. Those are the two slices of bread. And in between, there's going to be three times where Jesus predicts his death and his resurrection. The disciples don't get it. They don't understand. And Jesus continues to teach them. He doesn't give up on them. And so this is what we're going to be looking at tonight, this Markan sandwich and let's start. Okay, let's jump in. Chapter 8, verse 22 through 26. We're going to begin with the story of the blind man of Bethsaida. So you can see it on your screen right there. They arrived in Bethsaida. Bethsaida was one of the cities that's called the Evangelical Triangle. Jesus spent most of his time in three cities, in Chorazin, which we don't hear much about. Bethsaida, we do hear more about that one. And the one we hear the most about is Capernaum, which Jesus used as his home base during his ministry. So Capernaum and Bethsaida and Chorazin. Bethsaida was actually a fishing village, and it was located on the northwestern corner of the Sea of Galilee. You can visit there today. It's an archaeological dig today, and you can actually see some of the houses where they found fishing supplies in those houses. So it was a fishing village in the first century. So they arrived in Bethsaida. The people brought to Jesus a blind man and urged him to touch the man. Taking the hand of the blind man, Jesus led him outside the village. Jesus spit on his eyes and placed his hands on him. He asked him, "Do you see anything?" Looking up, he said, "I see people that look like trees walking around." Once again, Jesus placed his hands on the blind man's eyes. The man opened his eyes wide. His sight was restored. He began to stare, and this is a phrase I love, and I'm going to pick up on this phrase when we get to the practical points at the end. He began to stare with eyes wide open and to see clearly. Jesus sent him home saying, "Do not go into the village." In order to be a learner, we need to stare with eyes wide open. And this man is giving us an example of doing that with Jesus. The disciples don't do that as easily. And so we're going to see they're basically going to trip up in this next section quite a lot. But this blind man actually sees Jesus more clearly than the disciples do. Why? Because he stared at Jesus with eyes wide open. And we'll get a little bit into what that means later on. Boltz, a scholar, says that this pericope ought to be called gaining sight in stages. And you know, that's a good, that's actually a good title for this whole section of Mark, gaining sight in stages. And honestly, it's a good title for discipleship, because none of us come into discipleship understanding everything. We all learn in stages. And when sometimes we have easy stages where we're really learning and the lessons are very clear. Sometimes the stages are tougher and they're more difficult, but all of the stages are important. And none of us start out as a mature disciple. If we think we do, then we're really messing up. It just doesn't work that way. It's probably pride if we think that, well, I just arrived. The fact is that throughout our lives, we have to keep growing. And I love this story because this story is all about a second touch of grace. Jesus touches this blind man, but he's not healed the first time around. He sees things, but he doesn't see them clearly. He sees what he thinks are people, but they look like trees walking around. And so what does Jesus do? Notice he doesn't leave him in that situation where his sight isn't clear. Jesus reaches out and touches him again, gives him that second touch of grace. And Alyssa said, you know, that's the idea of Christianity being a contact sport. That's what Jesus did. He touched people to heal them. And in this case, he reaches out for that second touch of grace and helps the man to see clearly. In some way or another, Jesus has reached out to all of us to give us a second touch of grace. And often, let's admit it, a third, fourth, fifth, sixth, hundredth touch of grace. He never gives up on us. And then this next section, that's where we're going to see with Jesus and his disciples. They don't understand Jesus. They don't get Jesus. They misunderstand him, but he doesn't give up on them, just like he will not give up on us. And he will keep teaching us and helping us to be learners. Why did Jesus touch the man twice? Perhaps it's because this illustrates how difficult it is for us to see him clearly. And he needed that second touch, and we all need that second touch as well. It's difficult for us as people to give up our addictions. It's difficult for us to give up our bitterness and our negativity. It's difficult, as we talked about 2 weeks ago, for us to give up our fear and to cling to faith. That's tough. It's difficult sometimes to give up our legalistic tendencies. It's difficult for us to battle through the scourge of systemic racism and racial injustice, or just injustice in general. This is all difficult work. But you know what? We don't have to go through this work alone. Jesus is there with us, and he will give us that second, third, fourth touch of grace in order for us to learn. But in order to learn, we have to stare with eyes wide open. We have to really look at Jesus. And sometimes what happens is we get distracted by the world around us, and we end up looking more at the world than we're looking at Jesus. And that's always a mistake. We should really keep our eyes focused on Jesus and stare at Jesus with eyes wide open. That's one of the characteristics of being a learner, being a disciple. So now we're going to go, that's the first slice of bread, okay? Now we're going to go to the three pieces inserted in between the bread, and this is the prediction cycle. And we're going to look at three of these. It's beautiful how Mark crafted this. And so he talks about three different times, not once, not twice, but three different times. And three and a half, if you include the transfiguration, but it's a little bit different, has some similarity to it, a little bit different, but that could be a half, three and a half. But at least three times, very specifically, we see Mark having Jesus give a prediction of the cross and the resurrection. then the disciples misunderstanding him, they weren't learners like they should have been. But Jesus does not give up on them. He keeps working with them, teaching them to be disciples. And the first prediction is found in 8:31 through 9:1. So you can turn over now and look at Mark 8:31 through 9:1. And I will read this and make some comment. Okay. Jesus begins to teach his disciples that it was necessary for the Son of Man to suffer many things and to be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the experts of the religious law and to be killed and after 3 days rise. Jesus spoke plainly about this matter. That's the first part of the prediction cycle. He predicts his death, and he does it very plainly. He does it very clearly, and he wants them to understand. So he's spending time with them, trying to get them to see who he is, because they don't understand it. They don't get it. And they're looking for a Messiah like King David, or Messiah that's a political leader, a military leader. And that's not who Jesus is going to be. But he wants them to understand that. He wants them to get that. And so he's going to teach them not once, not twice, but three times. And also for three of them, give them the transfiguration. But notice what happens right after that in the text. It says, and this is 32b, Peter took him aside, and began to rebuke him. Peter doesn't get it. He misunderstands. Jesus is so clear. This is what I have to do. I am going to be, I'm going to suffer many things, be rejected. I'm going to die. I'm going to be killed, but I'll come back 3 days later. But Peter says, no, he rebukes him. That's a hard word that's used there. But that's what he does. In verse 33, Jesus turned and saw his apprentices, and rebuking Peter, he said, "Get behind me, Satan. Your mind is not on the interest of God, but on human affairs." See, Peter wasn't looking and staring at God with eyes wide open. He was looking and staring at human affairs, which when you do that, you automatically take your eyes off God, because you can't focus on two different things. So if there's anything else that your eyes are focused on other than Jesus, that becomes your sole and primary focus. So Jesus is rebuking Peter for doing that. And notice in verse 34, he summoned the crowd with his apprentices and said to them, and this is the teaching section. So there's prediction, there's misunderstanding, and there's teaching. We have to be learners. And he says, if anyone wishes to follow me, then you must deny self, take up your cross, and follow me. First thing he teaches is self-denial. We have to learn to give up our own wants and desires and replace them with Jesus's wants and desires. Then he talks about, second thing is to take up our cross. There was one purpose of a cross, and that was to die. We need to die to our own selfish desires and, again, pick up the desires of Jesus. And then the last thing was follow me. He teaches these three things: deny self, take up your cross, and follow me. And then there's a few other things that he says in verse 35, whoever wishes to save your life will lose it. Whatever loses your life for my sake or the gospel will save it. What profit is it if you gain the whole world and forfeit your eternal life? What would you give in exchange for your life? Whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of that person when he comes in the glory of his Father and with the holy angels. Jesus said to them, I tell you the truth. That's a rabbinic formula in which rabbis would make a pronouncement. They would use that formula. Jesus is making a pronouncement as a rabbi. There are some who are standing here who will not die before they see the kingdom of God come in glory. Jesus is all about teaching and preaching about the kingdom of God. And I think it's really interesting that the very next section, we don't have time to talk about it, and it's such a magnificent section, I wish we did, but it's the transfiguration. Sometimes we think, well, that's a prediction about Pentecost, the kingdom of coming, and some of them being there, some of them not being there. The fact is that in the very next instance, the very next story, they see the kingdom coming in power with the transfiguration of Jesus, because Jesus is the king, and he's a king that comes with his kingdom. Okay, so that's the first prediction cycle. Jesus predicts, the disciples misunderstand, and each time they misunderstand royally. I mean, they really misunderstand, to the point that Peter rebukes Jesus. I mean, that's bold for Peter to do that, but that's what he did. Okay, let's go to Mark chapter 9 now. Mark chapter 9, verse 30. Let's go down to verse 30. And in Mark 9, 30 through 37, we have the second prediction cycle. Here it comes, all right? So in this, again, in verses 30, 31, you have the prediction. In 32 through 35, the misunderstanding, another royal misunderstanding, and then some teaching. Jesus gives them a second touch of grace here. Let's look down and let's read it, at least read part of it. Let me see, verses 30, 31, we'll start there. They left from there and went through Galilee, and Jesus did not want anyone to know about it. Verse 31, he taught his apprentices, saying to them, the Son of Man will be handed into the hands of men, and they will kill him. After he has been killed, 3 days later, he will rise. And so it's the same prediction, different details, but he wants them to understand who he is and what he's about. And so he predicts his death and his burial and his resurrection very, very clear here. But then what happens after that? Well, if you look in verse 32, it says, but they did not understand his words. Misunderstanding. They didn't get it. And they were afraid to ask him about it. Look, fear enters the picture. We spent 2 weeks ago, 4 lessons talking about fear entering the picture. But it's throughout the Gospel of Mark. Because there's always this tension in Mark's gospel of faith and fear. Remember, faith drives out fear. That's why we choose faith and we let go of fear. Here, fear enters the picture and they're afraid to ask Jesus about their misunderstanding. Here's the thing. If you misunderstand something, you've got to plow through it. You can't let go. You've got to ask more questions. You got to seek to learn more. That's being a learner. They were afraid, and what did they do? They didn't ask. They were afraid, and they just were stymied, frozen in their fear. So they didn't become learners. And I'll talk about this later on. It's another practical point, but it's right here in the text. If you want to be a learner, then what do you have to do? If you want to be a learner, excuse me. 1 second here. Okay. If you want to be a learner, then you have to ask questions and you have to face this misunderstanding, which they didn't do. Okay. They arrive in Capernaum. After entering a house, he questioned his apprentices, what were you arguing about on the way? They remained quiet because on the way they had been arguing about which of them was the greatest. Okay. Now picture that. Jesus predicts to them, I'm going to die, I'm going to be buried, I'm going to come back from the dead in 3 days. And what do? They start arguing about who is greatest. They don't show compassion. They don't show empathy. They misunderstand Jesus. They're more focused on themselves than on Jesus. They're more focused on their place and their role than on Jesus. But Jesus doesn't give up on them. Instead, he uses this as a teaching moment, a second touch of grace. Verse 35, sitting down, Jesus called the 12 to him and said, whoever wishes to be first, he shall be last and servant of all. And he took a child and set that child in their midst. He gave the child a hug and said to them, whoever welcomes one of these children in my name welcomes me. Whoever welcomes me does not only welcome me, but my Father who sent me. So Jesus teaches them first, to learn to be last. That's what Christianity is all about. Christianity is about learning to put yourself last, put others before you. That's difficult. It's one of the hardest things for us to do, but it's the call of Jesus. It's the call of discipleship. Also, he teaches them to learn to serve, to be servants of other people. And to illustrate coming into the kingdom, he brings a child and sits them in their midst. And there's this little phrase there. I don't know if you even caught it or not. He gave the child a hug and said to them, that's such a beautiful picture there. And again, it shows that Christianity is a contact sport. Jesus doesn't just sit the child there, but he hugs the child. And I just picture that beautiful picture of Jesus hugging this child and talks about welcoming these children in his name. When you do that, you welcome Jesus. So it's bringing people into our community. That's what Jesus is saying here. And welcoming each other and caring for each other and learning to be last and learning to serve. These are lessons that Jesus is teaching. This is important because children were not really valued in that society and in that day and time. In fact, two scholars, Melina and Rogberg, say this: childhood in antiquity was a time of terror. The women in Luke 18, 15 through 17, who bring their infants to Jesus, are almost certainly asking him to touch them because they are sick and dying. Children were the weakest, most vulnerable members of society. Infant mortality rates sometimes reach 30%. 1 in 3 children died in childbirth. Another 30% of live births were dead by the age of 6. The next third that did survive, they died by the age 6. 60% total were gone by the age of 16. It was tough to survive childhood in that day and time. Children were always the first to suffer from famine, war, disease, and dislocation. In some areas and eras, few would have lived to adulthood with both parents alive. Children had little status within the community of family. While a minor, a child was on par with a slave, but not in the eyes of Jesus, not to Jesus. Jesus brought children in. Jesus welcomed children. Jesus hugged children. And Jesus also taught his disciples, you must do the same. He's telling us there, bring in those who are marginalized. Bring in those who are disinherited. Bring in those who are on the outside of society and welcome them in to your community. That's who Jesus was. And he's teaching his disciples that this is what they ought to do. So that's the second prediction cycle here. Now let's move on, and we will go to Mark chapter 10, verse 32. And in Mark chapter 10, we're going to see the third of the prediction cycles here. I hope you're with me. I hope you're following this. I know it's a lot of material, and I know we're going through it quickly, but I wanted to try to give you the big picture of what's happening. You can go back in your own reading and concentrate on it a little bit more. Maybe get a few more details down. So Mark chapter 10, verse 32 through 45, we see the prediction, the misunderstanding, and then the teaching on discipleship. Let's start with the prediction. Verse 32. They were on the road that went up to Jerusalem. Remember when I mentioned that when Jesus is on a road or he's on a way, it's not just for directions or just going from one place to the next. When Jesus is going up to Jerusalem, he goes there to die. And that's the call of discipleship, to go there, to follow Jesus with the cross and to the cross. And Jesus was walking ahead of them. The apprentices marveled at him, but the ones who followed behind were what? Afraid. There's fear again. Fear is entering the picture. It's all over the Gospel of Mark, fear versus faith. Once again, he took the 12 aside and began to tell them what was going to happen to him. For the third time now, he's predicting his death. Jesus said, look, we're going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and the experts of religious law, and they will, and he's more specific this time, the third time around, condemn him to death. Hand him over to the Gentiles. They will ridicule him, spit on him, scourge him, and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise. So this is the third time he's made this prediction. He's now made it in this instance with more detail than the other two times. You think, well, surely they'll get it now. I mean, I'm reading the gospel and I get it. Surely those followers of him, they will get it this time. Surely they won't trip up. Surely they won't misunderstand. But they do misunderstand. And again, they misunderstand royally. Look, right after this, verse 35, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, went up to him saying, "Teacher, what can we do for you?" "Teacher, we're sorry. You must be going through a lot right now. How can we help you?" "Teacher, tell us and we'll be there for you. Whenever this is happening, let us know. We'll be right beside you. We'll be there for you." You would expect them to say that because they've heard this three times now. You would expect some empathy. You would expect some compassion. You expect them to give him a hug. But look at what happens. "Teacher, grant us this favor. Do whatever we ask you to do for us." Wow. I mean, they miss it royally. Instead of showing compassion, they want to know, basically, will you grant our wish? Do us this favor. Jesus goes with that. Jesus said to them, "What favor do you want me to give you? Allow us to sit next to you in your glory, one on your right and one on your left." And they misunderstand. They don't know what they're at because Jesus just told them, "I'm going to die." There will be people next to Jesus when he's dying, but it's not going to be his disciples. It's going to be two thieves on either side of him. That is what it means to really be a disciple, is to be willing to go to death with Jesus. But they don't get it. They're still expecting a Davidic king, a political ruler, a military ruler. Jesus said to them, and this is where he explains it, "You do not understand what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be submerged in the immersion with which I am engulfed?" They said to him, "We are able." Again, it's misunderstanding. They don't get it. But Jesus said to them, "When you will drink the cup I drink and be submerged in the immersion which I am engulfed. But to sit at my right or my left is not mine to give, but it is for those to whom it has been prepared." In this case, the two thieves. When the 10 heard about this, they became angry with James and John. And of course, the 10 became angry when they heard about James and John. Most scholars say not because they were so upset that James and John weren't empathetic or weren't caring, but simply that they hadn't thought of it first. James and John were getting that favor, but they weren't. Okay, now let's look at the teaching, because Jesus, even with this misunderstanding, he still teaches. He gives a second, third, fourth touch of grace here. So in verse 42, we'll continue on and we'll see Jesus teaching them. "Jesus called all of them to him and said, 'You know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It should not be this way with you. Whoever wishes to be great will be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first will be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many.'" So this is much like what Jesus said right before this, the need to serve. If we're going to be disciples of Jesus, we must learn how to serve. So we've had the three prediction cycles now. Remember the first opening sandwich, slice of bread. That was a blind man of Bethsaida. Now we're going to look at the second piece of bread, in which these three prediction cycles are in between. And this is the blind Bartimaeus in Jericho. Let's look at this and then we'll make some points after this. "They came to Jericho. As he was leaving Jericho with his apprentices, a large crowd followed him. A blind beggar named Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the road. When he heard that Jesus of Nazareth was there, Bartimaeus began to cry out, saying, 'Son of David, Jesus, have mercy on me.' Many of the people rebuked him. 'Be quiet,' they said. But he cried all the more, 'Son of David, have mercy on me.' Jesus stopped and said, 'Call him here.' They brought the blind man, saying to him, "Have courage, get up, he calls you." Casting off his outer cloak, he jumped up and came to Jesus. Answering him, Jesus said, "What do you wish I should do for you?" The blind man said, "Rabboni, I want to receive sight." Jesus said to him, "Go, your faith has saved you." Immediately he received his sight and followed him on the way. Let me just make a few points here as we look at this part of the story. Jesus is in Jericho. Jericho is the lowest city in the world. It's 1,300 feet below sea level. It is one of the oldest cities in the world, perhaps the oldest continually occupied city. It's between Jericho and Damascus. There's a debate about that. But he's now in Jericho, which he's going to now begin his climb up to Jerusalem. So it's 2,500 feet climb up to Jerusalem. And while he's in Jericho, a crowd begins to follow. It shows the popularity of Jesus is still there. And there's a beggar named Bartimaeus. He's on the side of the road, probably because that's the place where he sits to beg. When he hears that Jesus of Nazareth is there, he begins to cry out, "Son of David, Jesus, have mercy on me." Now, Jesus up to this point has called himself Son of Man, Son of Man, Son of Man. He calls him Son of David. That's the messianic title. Bartimaeus, a blind man, sees Jesus as he really is and calls him the Son of David. And he wants one thing, not to sit on Jesus' right and left when he comes in his glory, not to be the greatest. He wants simply to see. That's what he wants more than anything else. Just have mercy on me. I want to see. And people begin to rebuke him. But notice he will not be quiet. Instead, what does he do? He gets louder. Now, I just want to make an analogy out of this, okay? And I think it's okay to make an analogy if you know you're making an analogy. But when you look at Bartimaeus, you see this is the heart of a learner. This is the heart of a disciple. He just simply wants to see better. That's what learners do. They want to see better. And when when things become tough, and people say, "No, stop speaking," he's like, "I'm not going to stop. I want to keep going. I want to learn. I want to be with Jesus here." And so Jesus stops and he says, "Call him here." And notice the crowd, they say, "Have courage," again, driving out fear. And he jumps up and he goes to Jesus. It says, casting off his outer cloak. The outer cloak was actually used with beggars to sit on and to collect the money that they got in their outer cloak. So maybe that's a symbol of him throwing off his own life, old life, throwing off his old way of living in order to get to Jesus. And Jesus asked, "What do you wish I should do for you?" And he says simply, "I want to receive sight." Very different answer than James and John. Very different answer than the other apostles. But Jesus says to him, "Go, your faith has saved you." And he immediately received his sight. And notice it says he followed him where? On the way. On the way is always important in Mark's gospel. On the way, where is Jesus going? He's going to Jerusalem. What is going to happen to Jesus in Jerusalem? Well, when we turn to the next chapter, we'll start to see. In Jerusalem is where he's going to die, where he's going to be crucified. When you follow Jesus on the way, you're following Jesus to his death. That's the walk of discipleship. And it's the walk that every disciple has to walk, the walk of the cross, the walk of following Jesus to his death. And that's what Bartimaeus is willing to do. He gets it. He understands better than the disciples understand. So what do we see in all of this? We see in this beautifully crafted section of Mark, a blind man at the beginning here, the blind man of Bethsaida, who needs a little extra help seeing. So Jesus gives him a second touch of grace. Then we see the disciples who don't see Jesus very well and don't see discipleship very well. But Jesus doesn't give up on them. So he gives them a second and a third touch of grace. Then we see Bartimaeus here, another blind man who shouldn't see Jesus very clearly, but he does see Jesus very clearly. And he follows Jesus along the way. In our lives, what we the way that we can look at this is, are we open to seeing Jesus clearly? Also, we all grow in stages, and Jesus is going to be there with us every step of the way. Jesus is going to give us that second, third, fourth, fifth, a 100th touch of grace. He's going to keep teaching us and keep working with us. The thing that we can't do is we can't just get bogged down and frozen and stymied in our misunderstanding. We have to push through the misunderstanding to be learners and to be teachable and to grow and to then see Jesus clearly. That's the key. Focus on Jesus, see Jesus clearly. If you want to be a learner, then stare at Jesus. So I want to close out with 3 points in this section on being a learner, being teachable, being a disciple of Jesus. And the 3 practical points go along with things that we've been talking about. Number one, stare with eyes wide open. And I want to just talk about this in relation to my own life and some things that I've been learning recently. Stare with eyes wide open. First, we have to acknowledge there's a problem. We have to be able to see that there are things that we need to grow in. And we have to stare at Jesus and not at something else. And I want to talk specifically about some of the ways that I've been growing in my own understanding of race and racism and injustice and these types of things. I grew up as a person of privilege in a racially segregated Southern city and a racially segregated Southern church. Later, I became a part of a multiracial church, but even with the diversity that was around me, I had much to learn about my own bias and my own prejudice. So what did I do? Well, I started to stare with eyes wide open. I started to try to look at things afresh. I started to listen to people, to hear people's stories. I began to read books that helped me to stare with eyes wide open. I read books by Howard Thurman and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and James Baldwin and Ta-Nehisi Coates and Isabel Wilkerson and Esau Macaulay and Willie James Jennings and others. And this began to create an awakening in me. Oh, there's so much more I need to learn, and I want to keep being a learner. I want to keep staring with eyes wide open. But that's where I had to start. I had to start by admitting that I had a problem that I did not understand. And I needed to start by listening and by exploring. And that's the way learners start. That's where they begin. They begin by staring with eyes wide open. So think of some area in your life where you know you need to be a learner. Maybe it's with pride. Maybe it's with a specific sin. Maybe it's with leadership. Maybe it's with using your gift. But whatever it is, and be willing to begin with starting by just opening your eyes, staring a bit, and reading, and talking, and listening. And then second, there's this struggle through our misunderstanding. See, part of the problem with the disciples was they misunderstood, and yes, misunderstood royally, but they didn't push through that misunderstanding. They just kept tripping over themselves in their misunderstanding. Peter rebuking Jesus. The question of who's going to be the greatest. And then James and John, can we sit on your right and your left in glory? They just kept tripping over each other. You got to struggle through misunderstanding. It's not easy to grow. It's not easy to change. It's not easy to admit mistakes or to admit failings and shortcomings. But learners do that. Learners, even when they fall down, they pick themselves up and they start over again. So we need to ask Jesus for a second and third touch of grace so that we can understand who he is and understand who we ought to be. My second and third touch of grace has come from being a part of the ICOC Teachers Task Force on Racial Reconciliation. We had a meeting just last night. It's such a wonderful, wonderful group. But I know that I don't get it. I know that I can't understand what it's like to be Black in America. There's just no possible way. So what I have to do is I have to push through and struggle through my misunderstanding. I have to listen. And I'm so grateful for the members of that task force that helped me to understand more about racial injustice, about systemic racism, about racial reconciliation. And I learned from them. Suzette Lewis leads the group. She's a Black sister from Canada. She's amazing. And this is her field. This is what she does. And I learned from her all the time. Andrew Lewis, her husband, is in that group as well as Joey Harris and James Becknell. All of them are Black. Steve Staten and I are the only white members on the group. And honestly, what we do in the group is we try to bring whatever biblical matters that we know that we can talk about. But I'm there and I learn and I try to push through my misunderstanding and I try to struggle to learn. So I'm grateful that I can be in a group like that, because it helps me to learn. It helps me to grow. And when I find places where I can contribute, which isn't often, I contribute whatever I can. But mostly I'm there and I listen and I learn. And then the third thing is to stay uncomfortable. Learners stay uncomfortable. We have to learn as disciples of Jesus to embrace discomfort. Don't run from it. Embrace it. Because if you run from discomfort and you run toward comfort, you're running away from discipleship. Three predictions of Jesus, and where did all those predictions go? To a cross. And all the disciples of Jesus ultimately had to suffer with Jesus, just like all disciples ultimately have to suffer with Jesus. So we have to embrace discomfort. Discussing racism is not an easy topic for me, because I grew up in a community, in a society, in a family, in a church, in which there was much white supremacy all around me. And so it's just not an easy topic for me. Maybe it is for you, but it's not for me. But I try not to run from the topic, because I'm not going to be a learner if I run from the topic. I ought to be a bit uncomfortable in talking about this. And it even makes me uncomfortable talking about it now. But that's because my background is a background of white supremacy and white privilege. It just is. And for some of you, you might coil at me saying that, but that's my truth. It's where I have lived. And it's not easy to admit that, but it's true. It's not easy for me to think about and talk about how my grandparents were. But I mean, they were racist. They just were. And I have to examine myself, because I know that there's bias and there's prejudice in my own life that I have to keep overcoming and I have to keep looking at. And when I get to the point where I'm comfortable talking about that and I don't embrace the discomfort, that's a very, very scary place to be. And it's true of any area of your life where you know that there's things that you need to face. So maybe it's addiction. Okay. Maybe it's a specific sin. Maybe it's a lack of growth in a certain area. When you get to the place where you're just comfortable and, you know, I'm just coming to church, I'm just showing up, I'm comfortable with all this, that is not a good place to be. It's not easy to grow, but embrace the discomfort, because growth is good. So it's difficult to put ourselves in uncomfortable situations. In fact, which one of us leans into discomfort? It's just, you don't really do that. You know, we lean into comfort. Oh, yeah. We put ourselves in positions in which we're going to be comfortable. Who walks into a room and there's one chair there that looks the most uncomfortable of all the other chairs? And that's where I want to sit. That's where I want to be. You know, there's a warm fire and everybody snuggles up around the fire. And you're the one person who says, you know what? I'll go sit in the corner where it's cold because I enjoy discomfort. We're just not that way. But we have to learn as disciples of Jesus, we have to learn to lean into discomfort. and be uncomfortable at times, because that's what disciples of Jesus do, because that's who Jesus was. Jesus not only leaned into discomfort, he chose discomfort. He left heaven to come to the earth to live amongst us. He chose discomfort. He was willing, he willingly went to the cross, the way up to Jerusalem. He chose discomfort, and he asked all of us to do the same. So how do we learn? We learn by staring with eyes wide open, by struggling through our misunderstandings, and by staying uncomfortable. And I want to encourage all of us this week to think about one area in your life where you want to be more of a learner. And I want you to apply these points to your life, to that particular area, whatever it is. Decide the area and then stare with eyes wide open and struggle through your misunderstanding and stay uncomfortable. Next week, we'll be talking about Jesus in the temple, and it's a great section because we get to look at 3 days in the life of Jesus, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday of the Holy Week. Thank you.
Amen.